Welcome to the podcast that's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee with our head coach, Chad Zimmerman.
Hi, everybody.
Our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hi, everybody.
And we are going to answer, that's awesome, united. We're going to answer more of your cycling and triathlon related questions today. You can submit them at trainerroad.com/podcast. We get a lot of them. This week, we got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of questions this week.
So Jonathan goes through all of them. So.
I do.
Thank you, Jonathan, for doing that.
It takes quite a while. But it's awesome, and we say this a lot, but I want to answer every one of them, but we just don't have the bandwidth to do that. The other day, I figured it out.
I have an idea, so go ahead first.
Okay.
So what'd you figure out?
This week, I'd be having to answer, this week with the questions that came in, I'd be having to answer 9 questions every minute. And these are like pretty long questions. Some of these questions, it takes 9 minutes to read, right? So it's a lot. So yeah, but
some fun math.
We try to pick every question or we try to pick questions that have broad applicability and also offer some entertainment too. So
what we do, this is a marketing effort.
Gotcha.
We say, Jonathan's going to stream live for 72 hours and answer these questions. Chad and I can come in for bathroom breaks, like when he has to go, and we'll 5-10 minutes at a time come back.
Slack, yeah.
Yeah, and he can break some world record that way, and we'll publish it.
A live stream marathon, shall we say?
Exactly.
Nice.
What do you think?
Sure. I mean, I think.
If you think that's a good idea, please comment. Send in a question too. Just kidding.
I can't say no, but yeah. With that, before we get into the normal questions that we have, a couple things that we want to mention. Nate, I'll let you take this first part.
Okay, number one, we are going to start including a image thumbnail of your Strava ride when it uploads to Strava. That's not the big announcer we're talking about. That's another kind of business thing because there's not a public way to do it. But so that's going to be there. I believe it's going up maybe as recording this podcast, but it's going to be very soon. The image, it's nice and clean, doesn't have any numbers on it, but it does give you, it gives you two things. One, it's an easier way to look back because even being at Trainer Road, Chad, you've written all these workouts. Sometimes you hear a workout name and you don't really remember what the actual workout was. Yeah. There's so many of them. And then by looking at the picture, you know exactly what you did and you know what you, how you did it. Did I turn it down? Did I have back pedals? Did I end it too early? So that's nice having your Strava feed. Two, there's a little bit of accountability too, is if I know that people are actually not going to just see the name of it, but actually see the image of it.
Yeah.
I don't want to give up at the end, right? People are going to see what I did.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so we've been taking pictures of our own Trainer Road accounts and just uploading them automatically. But I mean, if I bail early, people mention it, right?
Yeah.
Chad, have you experienced the same thing?
Oh, yeah. I think I quit Pettit one time and I took a lot of
Pettit's
crap
a recovery
for
workout for those that don't know.
Low aerobic, yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying that like you've experienced the motivational aspect of having people see your workout
every
after
workout.
The fact.
Yep.
It happens. So it also makes it a little easier, like when you share your workouts with your friends and everything else, they'll get a better idea of what you're doing, which is nice.
Yeah,
too.
like was it really, really hard or was that easy?
Exactly.
Not everyone knows that Taku is easy.
Walk in the park.
Yeah, walk in a park, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that's going to be pretty cool. Keep your eyes peeled. And if you haven't already set it up, you can actually sync Trainer Road with Strava. You just log in to your Trainer Road account, go into your profile, and then you can sync up different accounts from Garmin Connect, Strava, that sort of thing. Then it can push and pull and lots of cool stuff. Do you want to mention the beta tester group?
Yes, because there's on Facebook, there's a Trainer Road beta tester group. And in there, we have done an announcement of the new thing we've been teasing a bunch, but I've just teased you more because you have to go in the group to know what it is.
And we're pretty excited about it too.
Yes. So we've been using it internally for months and of course we like it because we made it.
I'm a fan.
Yeah, we're a fan. We're having people start the beta and I think we're going to start letting people in. Like we have a list of people. I think after this podcast, people are going to start coming into it and we're doing a, just so everyone knows, it's a slow release. So, it took us a year to build this, right? So there's a lot of stuff in there and we want to do groups of maybe like 100 people at a time so that we don't put everyone at once. And then we have so many things that we're running around and, you know, the idea is to find bugs and things that we might've missed or use cases that we missed and just make it awesome. So if you want to learn more about that, go to Trainer Beta Testers. We will do a full
Facebook.
Yep. Mm-hmm. We will do a full podcast about it and talk about all the features and everything.
Yeah, I'm excited for that.
3 years, so.
We can probably do, and keep your eyes peeled for that. We'll probably do a screen share so you can actually see what we're talking about too, which will be good. That'll be a ton of, I think that'll be great. I like leaked very minor information on my Instagram account yesterday, like very brief overview stuff. And I didn't share any of the details. And I promise you, once you guys see the details, that's when it's really going to like hit. So there's a lot of awesome stuff in there. So going to be great. Chad, you put down, so we have a document that we work off of for this every week that we prepare. And Chad put in something before we went in here. Yeah. Do you want to, I'll let you just take it.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So this is just from my for the record clarification, just little cleanup tasks, things that I realized after the podcast, I maybe didn't explain as well as I wanted to. Maybe I forgot something completely. In any case, it's a chance for me to kind of, do a better job than I feel I did. In one of the topics, and I, for whatever reason, every time we talk about pedal stroke drills, I neglect to mention these two things. And these are two primary motivators for these drills, why these drills are still here, why they were here in the first place, why they are here. I mean, we talk about we're not looking to generate more power from the pedal stroke. We're simply looking to make the pedal stroke more efficient, et cetera. That kind of touches on what I'm after. But in particular, a couple things. One is quad sparing. So quads are largely responsible for driving the pedal stroke. And if there's anything we can do to save them just a millisecond every pedal stroke, every of those thousands of pedal strokes we do in an hour or multiple hours, there's benefit in that. Even if it's just learning to turn it off slightly earlier in the pedal stroke, learning to activate it a little later heading down into the downstroke.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, have you ever done that like on a long climb? Been like, oh, I'm going to start scraping my feet for a while to have my quad stop hurting so much?
You know what I think of is like when a rocket launches off and it like jettisons one thing and turns on another thing. I'm like, yeah, one's out of gas. we need to bring another one in.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep. And so that kind of goes hand in hand with another thing that you know we practice whether we recognize it or not. And it's there's something called agonist-antagonist coactivation. So you know for every muscle, there's an opposing muscle. Otherwise, we'd be frozen in one position, right? We need one muscle to flex the joint and the other muscle to extend the joint. And in the case of the pedal stroke, we're looking at you know our quads activate on the downstroke. And then it is possible to carry tension in your hamstrings. You know, so those antagonist muscles can actually work against your pedal stroke. Mm. And by refining that fluidity in your pedaling action, you can start to negate some of that coactivation. Try to let your hamstrings relax when they shouldn't be involved, and let your quads relax when they're done with their. So that because you can actually, if you think about it, I mean, when you push down on the pedal stroke, you can keep a lot of tension in your hamstrings at the same time. That benefits nobody. There's no point in doing that.
Yep.
And with these pedal stroke drills, you know. Over time, we start to iron out that coactivation.
That's 100% right. And I feel like that's something that I haven't articulated before, but with the knee problems and everything else, usually when I have an imbalance or something else where I haven't devoted enough attention to proper strength training or balance within my muscle groups, I carry tension through my hamstring specifically throughout the whole entire pedal stroke, or maybe my lower leg, for example.
Yeah, we get all types of compensation, and most of it's not beneficial in terms of you know efficiency, letting the muscles that shouldn't be firing actually relax while the muscles that should be firing do the work.
Totally.
You've just like totally changed my workout today, right? Because I can sit here and squeeze or like flex my leg, and I can flex my quad, my hamstring.
Yeah, right.
Right? I'm thinking, well, am I pedaling? Am I, that's what you're saying, am I really like relaxing my hamstring when I should be pushing
Probably
down?
Probably not. I mean, it's a conscious measure for quite some time until you learn to do it more naturally.
And I think even more so, am I relaxing my quad on the upstroke? You know what I mean?
Again,
yeah.
And this is a marginal gain here, but I feel like this sort of work, especially if you race gravel or if you're racing mountain bikes,
I think it stops being marginal when you consider the repetition.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. I just think that when you are racing on uneven surfaces like that, the ability to have dynamic control over muscle groups and be able to operate them independently and have like a very clearly established communication line down to that, it really does help you become more efficient. We've talked about this a number of times, how a lot of the time a really good road rider will get onto a mountain bike and it'll be a pretty straightforward climb. It's not like it's a technical single track climb.
And you can see those inefficiencies.
But it'll have like, you know, it'll have some rock or something off camber slightly or something like that. And those little nuances of being able to control how your muscles are making those pedals go over really go a long way when traction becomes marginalized or gearing and pitch has you in a tough spot. It's where I really notice it making a difference. Yep.
I think too, with the far end of that, when you're doing a triathlon and you're in a fixed one position the whole time and you're just always using your quads, a little like be able to change that. is sweet relief. Like,
we got, and this is kind of going off of that in a different direction, but that nails home the importance of an important bike fit, or of a good bike fit, I should say.
Oh yeah.
Like how we got our bike fits. We actually, when we started to get into the proper position, we started to recognize that it wasn't just all quad anymore.
Yeah.
Now we are using posterior chain. So if you're in a bad spot, then it might just be tough to use anything.
I don't know if you intended that segue, but that's actually the other point I wanted to make in my for the record clarification bit here. You guys talked about how it's impossible to keep your sit bones engaged when you get into that aero position. I still disagree with that. So I kind of want to hear I'm guessing it's something Dan said, but I've started combing photos of Bradley Wiggins, Tony Martin, Fabian Cancellara. I mean, guys who obviously put a lot of power to the pedals and what their pelvic position was as they're doing it, regardless of how aero or narrow they are. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, yeah, they're tipped forward. And I don't know that that's necessarily, I think it might just be how they were riding at the moment. I don't know if that's a bike fit issue, but seems to me, and I would still argue that a grounded pelvis is regardless of how aero, and if you have to lose that anchored position, I think you're becoming too aero. You're going to lose comfort. Comfort's going to cost you power.
Becoming too aero?
Power's going to cost you. Yeah, too aero. Oh.
Yeah, like too aero for the power, you're saying. Or you wouldn't be able
comfort
to
put up first. Power. Yeah. I mean, if comfort breaks down, then power goes away. Aerodynamics goes away because you start coming out of position. I mean, comfort first. It sounds a little odd, but
I think that we probably misspoke on that, because it's not that your pelvis isn't grounded or stabilized on the saddle, but we were talking about how, since your hip angle opens up in a TT position a lot of the time, and then you're leaned over and you're stretched out perhaps a little forward, right, with your aero bars in that position, rather than having your pelvis rolled back as far, your pelvis is rolled forward. However, it's still grounded, and it's not rolled forward to the point that you're leaning on soft tissue, right? Like, it's not that far forward.
Okay,
at least
what you guys meant, but I wanted to know.
It's different saddles. Some saddles are designed to be ridden this way, with more of like the front of, not your sit bones, it's front of the pelvis. Yeah. And the idea is because of the, especially with, Dan explains it really well with the fist fitting system, is that as you, I'm trying to, I don't know how to show with my hands, but
if you're on the rotating, live podcast, you can see this.
It doesn't really help though. So, you're rotating forward. So you're going up, you're going forward, up and down, forward, up and down. Mm-hmm. And if you have to then keep your pelvis in the same relation to your body as you're going forward, up and down.
Yeah,
forward,
that must make sense to me.
And then, and you know, there's like the ISM saddles, the Dash saddle, Cobb saddles, some of the new Specialized, like the Specialized
Power or Sotero.
Sotero, I'm thinking of Sotero. Yeah, it's like it's made to be kind of like written, almost like you're falling off the front
a bit.
Yeah, and I might be doing it wrong, but I've heard NFL, like you ride where it's like kind of on either side of that. What's the nerve called down there?
Perennial nerve, right?
Yeah, the worst nerve ever.
Yeah.
Like it's either side of there, and my sit bones aren't touching at all. Yeah. And it takes a special saddle to be able to ride there and not have pain. And out of all those saddles I mentioned, I think I've tried almost all of them and only maybe like two of them I don't have pain. And it's also too, like, you get used to it.
Yeah. So far, well, I mean, you only rode it in a bike fit, but the Dash, you really liked it first try. So
I did. But again, it's on a fitting bike. So
who
knows if that'll be the long-term saddle.
And the one interesting thing is, even though you're rolled forward like that, there's still the pelvis is pretty shallowly guarded by tissue in that area as well. So it's still pretty well, it's making some good contact. Something along these lines, sorry, we're kind of digressing, but I found it really interesting. I saw on Tony Martin's bike, his Canyon, he still is running. So stepping back, there's a photo that's pretty gruesome of Tony Martin riding a TT bike at Virginia in the World Champs. And when he's riding that, he has sandpaper on his saddle and it's worn completely through his chamois, and he's bloody in terrible spots and it looks just absolutely miserable. But the reasoning that I heard behind that, and this is obviously rumor at this point now, but was that he couldn't get a good bike fit with that TT bike for him. So as a result, he had to be in somewhat of a compromised position, and the grip tape helped him stay there.
He did have to modify his position for a while, and then he went to, you know, that's why he got crushed so bad, or at least what he attributes getting crushed so bad at the Olympics, and then he goes back to Worlds on the previous fit, the one that had worked for him.
Yeah.
No longer those problems.
The interesting thing, though, he's now on the Canyon, which allows for a more flexible flexible fit, or at least it's known to provide a more flexible fit. Who knows if it allows the constraints that he needs, but that's what they've said at least. And he's got even more grip tape. That top of that saddle is very much covered in grip tape. It's really interesting to see.
That is actually the argument I was making, in that he became too aero. His position was so slippery that it was costing him comfort. Mm-hmm. That comfort was costing him power. I mean, it's just this is vicious cycle.
Yeah.
Then he went back to a position that was a little less aerodynamic, substantially more powerful, wins a world championship.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see how he performs, because I mean, the one thing I can think of, I'm sure when he wore through the sandpaper, wore through everything else, that level of discomfort has to distract from being able to ride if you're grinding on sandpaper in that area. But but it's going to be really interesting to see how this all plays out with finding the right position. And also, I wonder if a lot of those athletes, depending on the duration of the TT that they're prepping for, if they have the facility with mechanics and with everything else and with wind tunnel testing, that they know that like, this is my 20 minute position, right? Yeah. Like this is my 15 minute position. Yeah. This might be my 40K position.
Oh yeah. The importance of comfort grows with the duration of the event.
Triathletes have that.
Totally.
And a lot of the stuff too, you see at the Grand Tour level, it's the UCI is dictating position and you see them like, I think you usually see them scooting forward, right? They keep scooting forward because they want to be in that steeper position and open up their hip angle. Yeah. So as they push forward, they want that, but they can't push their saddle any more forward than where they're at. And triathletes out there, you don't have that, right? So you don't need to do it. And if a sign, I think, of a bad bike fit is as you're riding, you keep moving your bottom back and forth. And you're like, this doesn't feel right the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can see video of him, of Tony Martin doing exactly that. Sliding forward, pushing himself back, sliding forward. And you're basically fighting yourself the entire time.
Alberto Contador did that one of the TTs against when Lance came back. Just the whole time he won the TT. Yeah. But the whole time, like, I think he was clenbuterol, but or whatever. Yeah, it was something like that.
Yeah, something made the difference.
But just the idea that you can. If you're sliding back all the time, it's a bad thing.
And something that's interesting too that I thought of this week is, so the way that one of the constraints that's measured by the UCI is from the saddle, the nose of the saddle they measure, which I find silly because in the end, saddles are different lengths, right? But a lot of these pros, I was wondering why they aren't using snub nose saddles for pro TTs. But I think the reason for it is a lot of them have found that even if it's a snub nose saddle, where they sit or where they need to sit, still there's too much nose there. So they have these long noses on these saddles where the nose is more effective on a traditional saddle to sit on rather than a snub-nosed one where it's like smaller and more diminutive. So they have a long nose saddle and it's extremely uncomfortable probably, but that allows them to alter their position, so to speak, because it's more broad than the normal snub-nosed saddles, you know?
The snub.
So
I think part of that might be tradition too.
Could be, right?
Because the snub nose saddles, like, they're made to sit right on the edge, like right on the very edge.
Yeah, the only downside is that a lot of them taper off very early or they lose a lot of padding early. Whereas a traditional saddle that they might be using, like Tony Martin's, is pretty thick and padded looking, relatively speaking. Yeah. And it has a long, broad nose. And you can tell, even though he would be sitting there, that dude is sitting right on the tip of that saddle, you know, to try to be better there. So it's interesting to see how they have these things set up. And like you said, and this is like the hugest grain of salt that you should always keep handy, whenever you look at something from the pro peloton, remember that the fact that tradition reigns in many cases supreme in that sport. So you really have to, not every decision is purely data driven, you know?
And I can never say this brand, what's it, Physique. Physique, I don't think they have a snub nose, do they?
I don't think so.
But a lot of this stuff is sponsored. And I know sometimes people get away with saddles that are not their sponsors and they scratch them off. But I think if you're at that level, you kind of ride the sponsor stuff because that's what they want. That's what they're paying for to have Tony Martin ride your saddle.
Sure. Exactly.
And I'm not sure if that's the brand for Tony Martin. Right. But I'm just thinking some of these bigger brands don't have any stub nose.
Sponsor obligations dictate.
Yeah, exactly.
Equipment choices, right.
Just like you said, the old Canyon might not have fit him. But he had to ride one. If he showed up on a different bike, would have been weird.
Yeah, exactly. That one's pretty hard to cover up with tape. Yeah. with that, let's get into, so this is a question, we aren't going to address a specific individual's question, but this is a question that we get a lot. A lot of people are talking about this. Part of this is because it's very much a topic that's in vogue in nutrition right now, but ketosis and cycling and how they relate. We've talked about low-carb approaches. We've tested low-carb approaches. We've tested high-carb approaches on the podcast, and we've talked about at least our personal experiences with how they've worked out. But in an effort to kind of get down to brass tacks on this a bit and to more talk about what's going on in your body, we wanted to take some time to talk about keto versus, you know, keto versus high fat and low carb diets and get into this and kind of figure out what goes on in your body. Yeah. Chad, do you want to kick this off and we'll work through this together.
Anybody who's followed the podcast for any length of time knows that, you know, we're not opposed to nutritional experimentation. Nate and me especially, Nate a little more publicly, me a little more privately, but still, my approach has kind of been to figure out stuff that's not necessarily performance enhancing. I've spent the last couple of years figuring certain things out in the interest of just better health all around, but very little of what I've done has actually benefited my performance. And trying to go keto adapted has been one of those things. And we'll get into the specifics of why exactly it didn't work for me, why it probably doesn't work for most bike racers. Let's just say bike racers.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So yeah, we're treating that context here. Because the one thing that I know that with, especially with ketosis, is a lot of folks will bring in other examples of different athletes and everything else. But we're going to be talking with the context of bike racing,
where it's kind of suitable.
And we understand like nutrition is so like people are so passionate about it. And if you say like
cult-like,
it is cult, right?
Yeah.
If we talk, you know, we say something bad about. I'm going to pick on paleo people. Paleo people for a second.
Yeah.
They're going to like show up at the office, right? Yeah. With CrossFit dumbbells.
Yeah.
And what are you doing?
Yeah. Certain dietary approaches suit certain types of athletes. You can't argue that. I mean, there's a lot of support. You can certainly argue. You can always argue it.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of support. So we'll get into why I don't think a lot of support for a ketogenic diet and our type, or, you know, actual bike racers.
Okay, cool.
So first, the distinction between being ketogenic and just being on high fat. I mean, you can up the fat percentage of your diet and not be anywhere near ketogenic. Ketogenic implies that you've limited your carbohydrates to a point where your body has to find glucose and brain fuel basically elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. How does it do that?
So let's make it simple like that. In the absence of carbohydrate or in the presence of vastly diminished carbohydrate intake, again, that glucose has to come from somewhere. Your brain thrives on glucose. Mm-hmm. It can operate on ketones, but that's kind of what leads to this adaptation, assuming you restrict carbohydrate far enough. Mm-hmm. So once carbohydrate's not there, your body shifts into a different mode. It starts utilizing fat. Part of that fat is a glycerol backbone. So your triglycerides, 3 fatty acids tied to a glycerol backbone. That glycerol can be metabolized in the liver, converted to glucose. So there's a bit of glucose. Mm-hmm. It's probably not enough glucose. And I don't know if this is exactly how it works, but one of the byproducts of the fat processing, the lipolysis, are ketone bodies. So those ketone bodies can be used in a number of places, one of which is the brain. So in any case, now you're operating on different fuel sources. So instead of the typical glucose with a bit of fat, now it's predominantly fat with a bit of ketones and still a little bit of glucose in there.
And a lot of people, so ketones can be naturally produced in your body.
They're produced under a number of circumstances.
Okay. Yeah. And then people also can, they take them too. And we won't get too far into like how to become ketogenic ketones, and everything
not
else.
Even get into that.
But when you do this, I think that, correct me if I'm wrong, and I may be very wrong on this, but the theory is when you get down into that state where you deprive yourself of taking in carbohydrate, uh-huh, and you get into a spot where you're low on that, then your body is the intended benefit is to increase the amount of ketones that your body is producing or utilizing.
And really fat, honestly. I mean, the ketones are almost a side or a byproduct or a happy accident or reaction. It's really about becoming fat adapted and becoming able to better utilize fat as your primary fuel source.
I'm going to summarize a different way. I eat so little carbs that I start burning fat.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Hey,
that's it.
Pretty simply, but this is not something that just happens. It happens over, I mean, you have to go to great lengths. You have to really restrict your carbohydrate intake and you have to go through a pretty shaky period.
How many carbs, like how much do you have to restrict it?
The number they typically land on is like, I've seen as low as 30%. Some people can get into a ketogenic state with carbohydrate as low as 30%. In
not
most
30%,
cases,
30% of your?
30% of your diet.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. In most cases, it's like 10% or lower. I mean, people have to severely restrict carbohydrate.
I always read like 20 to 30 grams of carbs. Like,
yeah, and I guess that depends, right, on how much you're taking.
And it does depend. That's another thing. So some people can get keto adapted in the matter of a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. Some people, it can take months for them to fully adapt.
How can you tell if you're keto adapted?
You have to actually measure ketones. I mean, you can probably do it a little more organically. I mean, you could probably actually feel it, but you have to have some basis to know what you're feeling. And
yeah,
I know you get that, like, you get that ammonia smell in your breath. like a fruity ammonia smell.
Yeah, and that's one sign of ketones. It doesn't necessarily mean you're keto adapted, but you do. You have to measure. I mean, there's ketones in your urine, although that's not the most reliable way because that dissipates as you become keto adapted. There's ketones in your blood and there's ketones in your breath. They have breath analyzers. Blood's the gold standard, the way to go. But ketone strips are expensive. Yeah. It's quite a process. So you really have to get behind this. Yeah. I mean, this has to be full commit. You can't kind of fake this and ease your way into it. It's kind of an all or nothing thing.
I can't on the weekends eat donuts and Popeyes.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that. That's like a weak form of carb cycling, which is how a keto-adapted athlete tries to reintegrate carbohydrate into their diet such that they can engage in high-intensity activities.
Interesting. I was going to say, let's work our way toward now looking at it from an endurance athlete's perspective or a cyclist perspective.
I got the segue.
Okay, good.
So I've always heard carbs are good for cyclists.
Yeah.
So how could a fat-adapted athlete without carbs, like how does that all work?
It doesn't work very well, quite honestly. I mean, you basically have a ceiling, and that ceiling is sub-threshold. I mean, you can't do a heck of a lot of work that requires sugar. You can't get anaerobic for very long. There's not a lot of glucose in the system. There's not a lot of fuel to fuel anaerobic metabolism. Mm-hmm. So your workload or your work level is severely limited, which in the case of, and we've talked about this before, ultra endurance athletes, people who have to go for long periods of time, can't take on food frequently, don't want to take on food frequently, but can burn at a low rate, can better use fat to fuel really long, low intensity efforts. This is something that is well suited.
As you're more in ketogenic, does the level of what you can operate aerobically rise, or is it just kind of the same?
Yeah, and that's exactly what happens. So your aerobic capabilities rise way up, and you push that threshold aerobically closer. Well, anyway, to your VO2 max, mm-hmm. but you become very aerobically adept, really good at metabolizing fat for fuel.
And part of that, and the appeal to that I see a lot of people going with is, I got plenty of fat on board,
sure.
And we all do. So in theory, it's kind of like, I'm like a camel, right? Like I got all the fuel I need to keep going.
Yep.
But that said, so there are certain, like if you're doing something like a full distance Ironman bike leg, for example, that's, an effort where you're going to be under threshold because, 5-hour race, something
still
like that.
Still pretty high.
Though. Well under, but
and then there are other things to consider too. So, and I wanted to bring that up because I'm sure there's somebody going, but wait, my racing isn't over threshold, right? Mm-hmm. Like somebody might be saying that, but that doesn't necessarily
But even as you work toward
better.
Threshold, there's more and more anaerobic contribution. Mm-hmm. So I mean, again, the aerobic fibers can only do so much. They're low force, high fatigue rate or low fatigue fibers. I mean, they're set up to do a particular job. Fat can fuel that job really well.
We're back to that same. We're back to that same light switch or fader argument, in the sense that I think a lot of people think that if they're underneath a certain level, then it's just a light switch. And then if they surpass that, it changes. Mm-hmm. But like you said, there is anaerobic contribution the closer you get to that threshold.
And the bummer of this is, if you're a glycolytic athlete, an athlete who needs to be able to process glycogen, who needs to be able to do those super threshold efforts or ride close to threshold for long periods of time, fat adaptation or keto adaptation can actually damage your ability to utilize glycogen.
Yeah.
So there's a severe downside.
Like if you have a big race and you start to take carbs in,
you can't,
it's hard to use them, right?
Just switch back and forth like that.
Yeah.
There are adaptations that occur that take time. So to go back and forth is problematic. And some athletes talk about cycling carbohydrate into their diets in preparation for more glycolytic events. And there's plenty of science that says that doesn't really work.
Hmm. I don't think this point gets conveyed enough. So let's say it's an Ironman athlete, right? And maybe just during the Ironman bike leg, you're like, yeah, that's great. If I could operate at a higher percentage of fat, that'd be great. Be more aerobic the whole time. Wonderful. But think about your training, let's say over 8 months. And let's say your first FTP is 220, right? And then you go into ketosis and you push really high against that 220. But you're never really training over that 220 because it's hard to do. And you're in ketosis, right? Mm-hmm. So come Ironman race day, let's say you're at still 220, but you can operate at like 210, right? 210 watts for a really long time.
Mostly aerobic.
Let's take athlete two, and they're at 220 and they're eating carbs and doing over-unders and threshold and VO2 max intervals and really building it up and doing 2x20s, right? And they get up to 270 FTP. Yeah. And now they race
at 230, 240.
Yeah, exactly, right? And they are now a faster athlete and probably burning a higher percentage of fat than the athlete that stayed down there at that same threshold, yeah, but really got pushed up to it.
Yeah. Yeah, really, you just shift your substrate preference. You're just, you know, you used to rely heavily on carbohydrate. Now you're really good at relying primarily on fat. Mm-hmm. Doesn't necessarily make you faster. It just makes you a more efficient fat burner.
The other point I want to say too is if I was running, there's Western States 100 right out this window. It's a 100 mile running race.
Yeah, that's
Let's
a strong
say
case.
I'm already at a really high level, right? And now I'm like, oh, I'm kind of bonking in these races. I'm not going to push my pace up another 2-3 minutes. Now I want to try to get it where I'm going to burn more and more and more fat at that really long. Yep. I don't know how it's forever. It's crazy. Yeah. It's insane. But that's, I could see that as a strong argument to be in ketosis.
Yeah. So I mean, in those multi-hour events, you can't necessarily keep up with your carbohydrate expenditure, your energy expenditure. You can only take in so much glucose over the course of those races. So if you start to deplete, you can't keep up with it. Muscle glycogen is really good at maintaining intensity, but once those glycogen stores are depleted, refilling them or keeping sugar to the muscles via what you eat becomes really limited.
Yet something that I wanted to touch on with this too is I see a lot of people think, well, that way I don't have to carry food with me or I'm not relying upon aid stations. Mm-hmm. And while I could definitely see that being the case for certain races, especially if it's just like a point-to-point type of a thing, you're on your own. I could see that as being like a good fail safe, right? In the sense that you could rely on that. But in the majority of cases, we don't have to worry about that. Like Western States 100, I think it has an aid station every 8 miles, I think I looked
up. No, I thought you said 2 miles.
Or every 4 miles. I think it's like four miles, right? So plenty of that stuff there. There's usually well-stocked aid stations. Carrying food in a bike race, in most cases, I know there are edge cases, but in most cases, it's really not that tough. The one part that's tempting for me about this is the fact that since I have a sensitive stomach and it gets upset by a lot of nutrition products. So in my mind, I'm thinking my body wouldn't get upset by just taking, you know, taking in its own fat and being really fuel or effectively fueled off that. But I know, and I haven't reached anything that would be even close to ketosis, I'm sure. Having increased my fat adaptation, I have noticed the fact that while it may help me on long days on the bike, it doesn't necessarily help me in the type of racing that I do every day,
which
is more intense.
Improving fat adaptation so much as improving your ability to oxidize fat. And that's just something endurance training conveys anyway.
That's a good point, right? So the more I train and the more I raise my threshold, I'm going to burn more fat at that same wattage.
Exactly.
What we just talked about, what you just talked about, triathletes have known this for years, is they say nutrition is a sport.
Totally.
Right? Inside of triathlon. Mm-hmm. And you, they say, I have to train with what I'm going to have in the race day because it is hard to get in, to Chad's point, the amount of calories that you need for the race. Mm-hmm. So they're doing it. And it's, I don't have any science on this, but just anecdotal, if you do it a lot, it gets way easier.
Yes.
Like if you're eating gels every time, you're eating the same gels and you're used to it when you're racing or when you're training, it's easier than on race day to digest that same gel.
You have to train your nutrition too.
Yeah, I see ketogenic adaptation more as a lifestyle that dictates which sort of races you can then do. I don't like pursuing a keto diet in anticipation of furthering your performance or improving your performance in a particular sporting realm.
Yeah.
Rather, this is more about, you know, an improved lifestyle or a different lifestyle. The other benefits that come along with it, and then figuring out how you can tailor your athletic lifestyle to work with your keto adapted dietary practice.
The final note that I want to add to this is on commenting on nutrition being a sport. I was blown away this year at Park City Point to Point, that really long cross country race, 75 miles, all single track, really rough. I was blown away at how organized Keegan Swenson, who ended up winning it, was with all of his nutritional, like the plan that he had. First of all, he ate a ton, way more than I did. There are plenty of other reasons why he's a faster athlete than I am, but that's one of them, is that he knows that he needs to take in a lot of food and he does that. But they had since it was a long race and they had aid stations, but still, once again, nutrition is such a part to refine of your game plan. He had people placed at strategic areas so that they could hand them a camelback in one spot, and then he could take in a specific type of nutrition there very easily. And then he'd be able to meet a person at the top at a specific, because the speed or terrain was fitting for him to eat a specific other type of nutrition. Like, it's very strategic. And especially with an event like gravel racing or mountain biking, where it's not as easy as just sitting up and opening up a package and eating something. Sure, yeah. It's something that it really merits a lot of refinement.
I was just going to ask you, I'm doing another mountain bike race this weekend, and I wasn't going to carry a bottle because the you guys ever, you know, race and it's muddy and your bottle just gets covered in mud.
Yeah, yeah. Not it, pleasant to put your mouth on.
Yeah. So, I mean, in that situation, do you carry a bottle if they have hand ups?
Yeah, yeah. I still do for sure. Yeah.
But do you just drink the mud?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's fine. And
or just.
Yeah, exactly. Like if you grab it with your hand, grab it and then rub off with your palm, like that can be an easy way to do it. Now you have a bottle inside, you have bottles inside your triangle, so it's mm-hmm. not quite as bad. But if it gets splashed with mud and everything else, yeah, I mean, it sounds gross, but
you might eat a little dirt. I mean, it's mountain bike race.
I think too, it depends where you live. I used to live in Minnesota and my sister got Giardia, like beaver fever.
Oh. Yeah.
Twice. Oh. And I wouldn't, maybe in Minnesota, I wouldn't be doing that, but I think we have
clear
snowfall.
Yeah, that exactly. Are down and, yeah.
So my other question is, and then what about food? So, are you reaching in your back pocket? Cause it's hard on a mountain bike race. And this one is fast the whole time. I pretty much have to give up time to drink, where at Carson City, you know, you have a climb and you can easily just take it out.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that mountain biking is an ideal candidate for less solid food, in the sense that it's just technically difficult to be able to eat it, right? Mm-hmm. And also when you're jarring around with your stomach the whole time, I've heard that messes up, but I have no clue if there's science behind that. But I I'm trying to change that right now. I don't know if I want to mention like the name of the product I'm trying out right now.
Sure. Yeah. Cause I'm going to try it too this weekend.
Yeah. Okay.
So trying it.
Yeah. So I've been trying it and it's been working well for me. For those that are listeners to the podcast, you know that my stomach is fragile as a flower. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, and they, sent it to us.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we just got to say that.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. The company is called Maurten, Maurten. They were involved with Nike on their Project 2 when they were trying to go under 2 hours. They were heavily marketed in hand in hand with that.
2 hour marathon.
2 hour marathon. So it's extremely carbohydrate dense, and all it is just a packet of basically a powder that gets put in there. They use something, I believe that it's called like, it's basically gel. And then what that gel does is that gel ends up allowing them somehow to pack more carbohydrate into your drink. It's like 90 grams of carbohydrates in one bottle. And the crazy part is it doesn't taste bad at all. And it doesn't have much of a taste. If anything, it's like if you took a vanilla root and then just quickly like swabbed it through your water, like there's just a hint of something. It doesn't taste bad. And people around the office have been trying it too. And because the worst thing is those usually carb rich drinks taste, for me,
is the idea that you just take small servings frequently? What?
The idea is that you just fill up one bottle and then that bottle should be enough to give you plenty of fuel over the course of like an hour and a half race would be like one bottle or an hour race, something like that, I believe. Yeah. So, and then they have more dense. They have like double the dosage that you put into the same bottle. They're very strict on mixing it with the right amount of water.
Sure.
But it's interesting stuff. And I'm trying that in hopes that that can be something that I can use for mountain biking, because I face the same problem. And I usually end up taking in something like a block or something like that, because I can just quickly kind of grab that and mash my hand and mash it into my mouth and go with it.
It's still hard though.
It is hard. And then it's harder to chew that too when you're dealing with technical stuff. And then
trash.
The other thing that I've been working with is trying out, and this is dropped off to us at Cyclocross Nats, but from Science and Sport, their gels, because they're much more watery than normal. Mm-hmm. And that's the first gel that I've used that doesn't mess up my stomach. Because I'm really trying to get away from the whole, you know, using solid foods on the bike quite as much for like shorter races, especially because Leadville looms large and I want to make sure that I have my nutrition plan down for that.
So like that's a good example. Leadville would be, we're going to have lots of solid food and sports drinks, but in a cross country 2 hour less mountain bike race where it's like the whole time, that's me shaking my arms and jarring.
Yeah.
It's hard. So I'm going to try that too this weekend. Chad, you've mentioned Superstarch a few times and you like that.
For long, slow stuff. Yeah.
I like CarboPro for the long, slow stuff. I'm sure this company has a reason.
Yes.
But I also think, well, I'll just put double scratch in. And I think Alan Lim would probably be like, what are you doing? That's going to mess up the osmolarity. But maybe I'll try it and see how it works, right?
Yeah. Try it and see.
Yeah.
Yeah. With that, actually, I'm going to jump ahead because there's a question that specifically deals with this, guys, and then we'll end up jumping back. But there was a question, and we have it as question number 7, by the way, guys, but it's from Scott, and he says, Hey guys, thanks for the great podcast. I've been back listening to a library of podcasts and I just listened to the pre and post podcast for Carson City Off-Road, a mountain bike race that last year was much more single track than it will be this year, and it is traditionally. It was pretty difficult to eat last year because it was, there was the road section coming back that was a time to eat, but it was a lot of single track. It was technical single track and hot, extremely hot. So he says, it's possible my question gets answered in a later podcast, but as you all were talking about hydration, I was wondering about how much fluid it takes to digest different foods used on the bike, i.e. pro bars, gels, waffles, etc. My guess is that it takes far more fluid to digest pro bars and gels, but is it enough to actually make a difference?
Yeah, my guess would be the same as yours. And unfortunately, that's all it is, because research this as hard as I did, I couldn't find anything that was specific about, you know, the more dense a food product is, any amount of hydration you need to tie to that. So I really ended up just looking at this in terms of hydration versus dehydration and what the effects are on digestion. And obviously hydration works in terms of digestion. I mean, your digestive tract has to be, you know, flexible, pliable, remain lubricated. You dehydrate and you get constipated. It's pretty simple. Yeah. Obviously that's to be avoided. One of the arguments is that ingesting fluid, you know, water in particular, will dilute stomach acidity and tone down the gastric juices. I couldn't find anything reliable that would support that. And I found one pithy little comment by, I think, Johns Hopkins that says, nope, that's not true. Didn't cite any study or anything, just said, you know, Johns Hopkins says no.
Interesting.
So yeah, obviously you want to remain hydrated. And if you're putting a big wad of food into your belly, that could compete with working muscles in terms of, you know, water balance. So that,
Go ahead.
Yeah. Something I wanted to add on this was, think about when you are working hard at Carson City Off-Road, for example, like just brutally hot, your body's throwing a whole lot of water out to the skin as much as it can to try to cool that thing off. And if you aren't taking in that water, it can really affect your ability to process that food.
These questions are so hard to answer because we don't know. There's not like an exact science, or no, there probably is an exact science. There's not an exact recommendation. Mm-hmm. Different companies have very different stances on this for nutrition, so they're not even in a line. And maybe some of that's marketing, maybe some of that's science, but also maybe one study's here and one study's here, and they both take their own study or their own university.
Yeah, I did find one study that tied dehydration to digestion, and it didn't tell us anything we wouldn't expect. Actually, there was something surprising. It slows gastric emptying, so that's pretty obvious, and that can lead to stomach cramping and nausea. No surprise there.
Makes sense.
It did show that dehydrated versus hydrated did not change intestinal permeability, glucose absorption, plasma volume, rectal temperature, or something else that I'm not going to bother you with. So that was a little surprising that even in a dehydrated state, glucose absorption wasn't affected. So that's good news. But, you know, you got to deal with stomach cramps and nausea in that dehydrated state to still get that glucose. So obviously not optimal.
And this is not a study. Once again,
that was a study.
Not a study.
Okay.
Chad's was. But I can say this much, and I feel like everybody would be able to relate to this. When you put in food that is solid food, or maybe it's dry food or anything else, and you aren't taking in as much water, it can be extremely distracting to performance.
Yeah, good luck getting that down.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's really tough to do. So I actually look, for example, like rice cakes, and I eat rice cakes. I usually water them. I make the rice a little more watery than it would be, so it's a little bit more swollen, carries a little bit more moisture in there. Mm-hmm. I try to make sure that I pick foods that are a little bit more moist for that reason.
Well, it's tied to intensity too. I mean, and you know, heat, obviously a factor, but if you're, you know, working very hard and you try to put a rice cake in your mouth versus if you're noodling along at, you know, 60% of threshold and you can grab a gulp of water or two. I mean, it's obviously that's a factor.
Yeah.
I think the work.
All of this stuff is so, there's some basic principles, and I'm just going to, we didn't talk about this ahead of time. I'm going to say this off the top of my head. Okay. Basic principle number one, be hydrated, but there's a limit, right? Two, you can't drink too much. But principle number two is if it's anything long, make sure you take in electrolytes because you can actually.
In particular, sodium.
Kill yourself.
Yeah. Well, when you talk about, so when you talk about hydration, it's, I've these days, I look less at water balance and more at sodium balance. I mean, the two are tied closely. But I mean, we want our bodies to stay hydrated, but it's not as simple as ingesting straight water. There have to be certain things that go with it. And the more you sweat, the more sodium you lose, the more important it becomes that you balance that sodium back out, that you actually ingest sodium. And most of the hydration fluids these days account for that really well. Mm-hmm. And they also include a little bit of glucose, a little bit of carbohydrate. Those co-transporters, sodium and glucose, push a lot more water into the cells than water alone.
And so when you're in a race and you drink too much water and you flush out all the electrolytes, you don't have to be in a race for this to happen, but you get in a state called hyponatremia. And when you're in that state, the electrical
signals— low blood sodium.
Yeah, and you actually die. So at the Chicago Marathon, a couple years ago—
You can. I mean, those are the direst of circumstances.
Well, yeah. But people actually died in the Chicago Marathon. And it's usually the people that are doing the 5+ hour marathons, and they're drinking water at every station.
Yeah,
they don't want any carbs. They don't want any sports drinks. Mm-hmm. And you drink so much that you actually, like, your body can't fire electrical signals anymore, and you die. But I haven't ever, and I've heard about that a few places, never heard of someone dying of dehydration, which is just performance awful, and you sit down, and you eventually get water.
So if you're thirsty, then it's too late. You're already dehydrated. So what? So you're a little dehydrated. The push is to drink ad libitum based on thirst. I mean, your body's really good at regulating that sodium balance. You get thirsty, it says you're out of balance. Fix it. Mm-hmm. And to actually endure hyponatremia to a point where it results in death, that's a pretty severe situation. I mean, these are people who are pounding straight water, even though they're not sweating out anything. They're not—
Well, it was a 100-degree day too, so they were sweating the whole time. Yeah. Super hot.
So that's it. They're just depleting those sodium stores to a deadly level.
So the first one, be hydrated. Two, take some electrolytes if it's anything long. And two, if you don't want glucose, there are products where you can just get salt pills. I know a lot of triathletes do that.
Not salt pills, sodium pill.
Electrolyte.
That goes along with the sodium is problematic. Your body doesn't lose chloride at the same rate it loses sodium. So when you replenish with a salt tablet, you're adding too much chloride to the system, and that causes its own host of problems.
So and brands have their own, like Hammer has one, I think Goo has one. Mm-hmm. Or you could do a mix that puts into your drink, and it sounds like it would be like a salt water, but it's not. The third one that I think is experiment with everything else, because I've never seen where this is the way to drink and eat, and then it goes right across the whole board. But I have seen time and time again somebody having this journey where they try many different things, and then they lock on something that's awesome.
Well,
and then that's their thing.
One thing that influences that is people lose sodium at different rates.
Yeah.
I mean, per milligrams per liter of sweat, you have a range that runs from like 300 milligrams all the way up to 2,000. So you can be someone who just dumps sodium. You obviously need to put more sodium back in the system than somebody who loses it at a much lesser rate.
Yeah. I like my three principles.
Yeah, they're solid.
They're solid principles. They're basic.
Yes.
Just like me. You're basic. But it's a lot of people, they go, hey, Chad does this, so I should do this.
And then
they
struggle with it. Not that simple.
Exactly. That's my main point of this whole thing is experiment.
Yeah, not many people can do what
you
Chad
can actually
does.
Get a sodium test.
I know,
not many. Yeah. And you can get a sweat sodium test.
Early That's... morning drinking. It's all beer in there.
That's why I get friendlier as this podcast goes on.
That's true. Yeah, there we go. Let's roll up back to Daniel's question. So up in our doc here, but he says, "Thanks for what you do. What are the and this is short and sweet. This is awesome." He says, "What are the different adaptations that occur from an over under workout versus a 3x20 sweet spot workout?"
Can you describe the difference between those two first for those who don't know?
Yeah, so I mean, sweet spot, just pin it right around 90%. You know, whatever the range is, different people or coaches define it slightly different range. So let's just put it right about 90%. So we're substantially or well enough below threshold that it's not quite as demanding as threshold work. Mm-hmm. Well enough above tempo that it's noticeably more demanding than aerobic endurance sort of stuff.
And then over-unders.
Over-unders, you walk that lactic threshold line. So you're slightly under it where the you're keeping up with your lactate production. And then you push above it to where you're actually flooding to the point where your blood becomes acidic and you start to back off. And then we dip you back below threshold just in time to allow you to ride through it and clear it off and then, repeat.
Which some people, based off of perception, might argue that it's enough time to complete.
Yeah.
It's always very uncomfortable.
They're brutal. But the benefits that go with sweet spot work as opposed to or along with over-unders are basically the same. It's just the order of magnitude. Mm-hmm. So it's a stronger stimulus. So if you use Dr. Andrew Coggins' expected physiological and performance adaptations, where he ties all the physiological adaptations that you'd expect from training to the seven power zones, mm-hmm. everything's basically the same. You just, you know, as you push more toward threshold and above threshold, you get bigger increases in different adaptations. So, you know, plasma volume improves, and that's beneficial in a number of ways, but especially in terms of thermal regulation, mm-hmm. Cooling. Mitochondrial enzymes, so how well, you know, your mitochondrial, the aerobic powerhouses, can do their jobs. Mm-hmm. Cardiac output, you know, your heart actually becomes able to pump more volume, push more blood and plasma to the working muscle. Increased muscle capillarization, so better bedrock of or network of blood delivering vessels to the muscle itself. Hmm. And a number of other things, slow twitch hypertrophy, you know, your slow twitch fibers get a little fatter, a little more capable, more work, a little more force output.
So these benefits are shared by both.
Again, it's just order of magnitude. The one thing you do get with over-unders that you don't get with sweet spot work is improved lactate threshold. I mean, and you actually do get it. It's substantially better with over-unders and lactate tolerance, which
that's a key.
Is a little more on the psychological side of things than the physiological side of things.
So why?
But there's both.
Why wouldn't I just always do over-unders then and never do sweet spot?
Because they're brutal. So they're just hard. And it's just like anything. I mean, your training, your mindset stagnates after a while. You got to mix it up a bit. But threshold or sweet spot work does, you know, basically all the same things, and it's a lot less taxing on your system. A lot easier to recover from. You can do quite a bit more volume, as Nate has been demonstrating over the last couple of months.
That's what I wanted to get at too. With it's psychologically demanding to do those over unders,
comparatively
speaking,
well.
And physiologically as well.
It's a lot harder to bounce back from a threshold workout than it is a sweet spot workout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a huge part, and you can get more time. So the time's not the same. Mm-hmm. I doubt anyone's doing 3x20 over unders.
Oh,
right.
Yeah. Have you looked at it just in terms of training stress?
Yeah,
you can do. I mean, you can match the training stress between the two types of workouts, but you're going to bounce back a lot faster with the same amount of training stress from sweet spot work.
Mm-hmm. So, how I view it is like, two, we have a limited amount of mental energy, mm-hmm. and all that sweet spot stuff, which I'm doing right now, it's still getting a lot faster doing sweet spot, but
it
prepares you for the threshold.
Totally.
Right.
Yeah.
And then when you get to threshold, and it's. Those are, you know, we started out with over-unders, I think, at like 8 minutes, mm-hmm. right? Because they're mm-hmm. hard. And then we build from there and progress you through that over-under. Yeah,
even six, I think they're short of six because they're tough.
They're difficult. The one thing I could say too with, and I believe this ties into a lot of psychological preparation, there are certainly physiological adaptations that happen too with over-unders like this, but in many cases, unless you're doing like a very steady time trial that doesn't have a lot of change to it or anything else like that, I've found that when you get out into a race scenario, power changes constantly. Mm-hmm. Things are moving around.
You're effectively doing over-unders the whole race.
Yeah, a lot of the time you really are. And so I find that when I go into over-unders, so a lot of people, and this has been my observation, a lot of people, when they see over-unders on their schedule, right? That's the next workout in their training plan. It's like, this is going to be really hard, right? Mm-hmm. When I see those, I actually get excited, not because it's easy for me or anything else like that, but I look at that and I think, ooh, this is exciting because this is like really good race prep. Mm-hmm. And I know that when I'm doing this, I'm getting even more out of it. I don't do it all the time because I know that that's not smart, because if I do that all the time, it's going to be tough for me to recover. But I do actually really like those workouts because I know I'm getting a lot out of
it. Yeah, if you looked at it just from a psychological perspective, just being able to well your muscles up, put yourself in a really uncomfortable spot and to gradually work yourself back out, or maybe not even work yourself back out right away, to be able to tolerate it for longer and longer periods of time. It's a huge, huge boost mentally.
It saves a lot of time, right? John's just talking about mental toughness, like mental games. I love what you just said mm-hmm. about how to become faster. Mm-hmm. Another thing is you can't do over-unders every day. So I know in our build plans, they'll be like Saturday might be over-unders, but then Sunday is a sweet spot work. Because you can't, you know what I mean? You can't back it up every day because it's just, you couldn't do maybe you could do 2 days of sweets or of over-unders together, but that would be like if I tapered into it.
Even if you tried to alternate days, it would just grind you down. I mean, I'm looking at 5-6 weeks of that before you just wanted to quit bike racing altogether.
Yeah, remember that when you dose your body with training, there's stress that gets put onto your body there. And when you recover, you're able to absorb the benefits really from that, right? And it's so it's something that's really important for people to consider. So.
They both have their place.
They do, that's for sure. Next question is from James. He says, I find myself in a more time-restricted morning workout slot than the questioner in episode 135. My alarm goes off at 4:45 a.m. and I try to be pedaling ASAP, typically within 10 minutes, so that I can get a full workout in before I need to get the kids ready in the morning. This obviously leaves no time for pre-workout digestion. Right now, I'm in high volume sweet spot base 2, so all the workouts are 90 minutes to 2 hours in length and nothing that pushes me into the red. Mostly, I'm getting through them without no food or coffee, just water, but I've noticed on multiple occasions that the workouts feel harder than they should and workout quality occasionally suffers. Mm-hmm. I assume what he's talking about with workout quality occasionally suffering is his ability to hold the targets consistently across the board.
Sure of it.
So he asks, is there any benefit to eating the, and he has a number of questions here, but we'll just address them one by one. Is there any benefit to eating the tasty sounding English muffin with honey while warming up?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, in your case, this is your only option, so you got to do what you got to do. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, if you ingest something right at the start of a workout, it's an excellent time for your body to uptake that. I mean, once your muscles start working, we don't even need insulin to get the nutrients into your muscle cells. Mm-hmm. So do it right then and there and expect a pretty immediate, you know, relatively speaking, benefit.
What kind of food would you suggest then to eat right when they
super
start?
Simple. I mean, simple carbohydrate. You could probably get away with something that's not terribly simple, but I certainly wouldn't push anything with fat, anything with fiber, basically stuff that burns quickly, metabolizes quickly.
Minimum protein too.
Oh yeah, and protein, yeah.
Yeah.
No. I mean,
This goes back to our ketosis question a bit because how many people I've talked to who they're like, great, I did an FTP test, endurance workouts, great, tempo, great. I woke up and did over-unders and it was really hard. And if you're on ketosis, you don't have those carbs. But when you wake up in the morning, it's not to the same extent as ketosis, but you don't have those carbs. And I feel like, I can feel it myself too. If you don't eat for your next workout, like I feel like I'm always eating to make the next workout hurt less.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it just makes in training so much more enjoyable to go into it because the amount of power doesn't change, right? That's a given. All I can do is change how I'm going to prepare myself coming into it.
Yeah, yeah. Right? We always talk about fueling for the workout. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that workout isn't till tomorrow or the next day. And there are considerations to be made well in advance of really taxing, depleting workouts like threshold work, sweet spot work, over-unders.
Do you think that James could eat anything the night before? Like maybe slower, like oatmeal before bed?
I mean, he just wants to top off his muscle glycogen.
Yeah.
So as long as that's topped off for something like, you know, an hour and a half workout, he's good to go. For something that's, you know, hour and a half, 2 hours with a lot of work, a lot of, you know, constant muscle stress. We're not talking like VO2 where you're on for a little while, then you're off for a good long while. But sweet spot work where for long durations, you're working steadily. That can, your muscles can only pack so much.
The high volume sweet spot based 2 hour workouts, they're pure evil, Chad.
I know. They're big fitness builders. They're huge burners.
Yeah.
And I'd say those two though, you have to be topped up glycogen wise or it's going to be very mentally tough.
Topped up. Because again, I mean, what your muscles, you limit what your muscles can do when you simply rely on the carbohydrate you're eating. Mm-hmm. What you ingest cannot keep up with as well as your glycogen stores can. So the onboard muscle or the onboard sugar stores in your muscle is far more effective at fueling the work.
Transitioning from this, and this we've danced around and touched on this quite a lot already on this episode, but the next question that he has is how does pre-workout and intra-workout nutrition change depending on length and intensity?
That's kind of what we're talking about.
Yeah. And something, once again, this isn't necessarily a light switch thing. It's a system of faders that end up working together. So it's not like, you know, you cross a line and you're done and you never use that type of fuel again until you drop back down, something like that. But this is something that perhaps I think a lot of people don't consider when they're getting ready for a race or anything else like that beforehand is not just taking in what you can, but you know, think about the actual work you're doing because it does matter, right?
Yes.
Yeah, like the type of nutrition or the type of or the intensity that you'll do does have an effect on what you'll actually need to eat.
And ideally, you know, you eat a few hours prior, you know, 3 hours is kind of the cutoff to where your body can fully digest it and it's into the muscles. It's out of the digestive tract or at least far enough down it that it's not going to affect you. One thing to avoid, and I've experienced this and I know you've described it before, is eating like an hour prior to a hard event.
Mm.
That's hard.
Dang near the worst time you can do it because it's like this imperfect storm of, you know, like I said, working muscle doesn't require insulin to drive the nutrients into the cells. But an hour prior, insulin's in the system. So the insulin release has taken place. So you got that working. And your muscles don't need the insulin. So you basically force yourself into this hypoglycemic state where your blood sugar is low because, well, I just described why. Yeah. And it's super uncomfortable. And it's far from confidence inspiring when you're starting a race and you're already feeling low.
Yeah, I start shaking.
Yeah, and that's like, hypoglycemic response right there.
While I'm riding, and I find that I'll have to eat something and then it takes like 25 minutes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And maybe I could eat something that's better, like pure honey or something.
If you're in a pinch and you're going to eat just prior to a race, do it just prior to a race while you're sitting there at the start line, you know, 5 minutes prior, listening to the marshal describe the course.
To clarify, that's not ideal, but that's like if you're in a pinch type of situation.
No, it's not bad. I mean, we're assuming or hoping that you're already loaded up.
Exactly right.
So I do both. I do, for a race, I'll do 3 to 4 hours before, eat something big. Mm-hmm. And then as I sit there, I'll be eating, choose.
Perfect.
Because I want that, especially for those mountain bike races where I know I'm not going to eat later.
And start fast.
And again, principle three, as we go back, I'm just going to call it principle three from now on, that I have tried this in training many times and in indoor training and that kind of stuff. That's all I have to say.
Awesome.
No, actually, here's the other thing I was going to say is for talk about different intensities.
Yeah.
Sweet spot based high volume, Chad, again, evil. There's so many workouts. And I'm doing like, I slightly modify the plan as we've talked ad nauseum about, but 6 days a week, even on my easier days, which I always do, was one called Baxter, which is just for those non-trainer users, aerobic. I'm still thinking about the next day because
on a plan like that.
I could do Baxter with nothing. Like, hey, I'm gonna lower my glycogen stores a little bit. And it's not that glycolytic while I'm doing it. But then the next day, I've got 15-minute intervals.
Handicapped yourself.
Exactly. So I'm trying to, it's just a different, I don't think a lot of people think of it that way. The mindset is if I'm going to train every single day.
Yeah, look at the succession of your workouts. That's a big concern, especially when it comes to something as depleting as sweet spot work.
Yeah. So I'm actually doing sports drink as I'm doing those aerobic rides, which I know some people are like,
they're thinking like they want to not take in as much because it's an easier workout and it's a good chance to maybe cut weight, something like that.
Sweet spot does not qualify as an easier workout. Not in my eyes.
Yeah. It's tough work.
You need a lot of fuel for, you know, 10, 20 minute efforts done at 90% of threshold.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough work.
What about if you're doing something, Chad, like really short, like 30 second anaerobic efforts early in the morning?
Assuming it's, you know, a 60, maybe 75 minute workout and that the work done in that workout is substantially less than that, considering all the time spent recovering, you probably, assuming you didn't starve yourself or skip dinner, probably have enough glycogen on board. And on board, I mean, in the muscles to get through that workout, no problem. Hmm. Then it's really a question of fueling afterwards to mitigate all the, you know, harmful physiological responses that come with that high intensity work.
Another idea I've been thinking about is I haven't been doing any post-race drinks because I've been taking them just while I work out. And that anaerobic 30-second one is great because there's usually big periods of rest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So right afterwards, I'd be like, I'm going to eat a banana right now.
Yeah, you can do it.
And there's always, they talk about that window and stuff, but in my brain, I'm thinking like, I'm off the bike. It's already in my stomach. Everything's there.
Yeah.
It's ready to go. What do you think about that?
As we discussed, that window doesn't close. Mm-hmm. So it's not to say, I mean, I'm assuming the food you're eating on the workout is meant to fuel the remainder of the workout. You're not doing it as a recovery mechanism. Mm-mm. And so that's what it is. So then really it's just a question of when you get off the bike, adequately refueling to stave off any of the harmful effects of the high intensity work and to prepare yourself for the next workout.
And hopefully what you've taken in hasn't put you too deep in or has lessened that hole, right?
Yeah. We talked about
Yes,
Jonathan.
I like that.
Window doesn't close, right? We talked about that a couple podcasts ago. It closes gradually, but it never closes entirely. You're always capable of uptaking glycogen. It's just you're really sensitive to it just post-workout and, you know, for a while past that workout, depending.
Awesome. We're going to jump into the last question of the actual podcast here, but if you're with us live for the live stream on Facebook or YouTube, stick with us and we'll answer your questions after this. We're going to go to Ron's question. He says, love the podcast and I'm a proud attendee of your first live podcast you did at Rafa San Francisco. Awesome, Ron. Good to hear from you, man. He says, my triathlon, and by the way, we don't have one of those planned yet in terms of doing another one at a Rafa Cycle Club. We got a lot of suggestions from you guys on where to do them, and we have those present and acknowledged and noted, so we will be planning one at some point. But we do actually have some pretty cool live podcast plans coming up for the spring, so we'll share those when that has happened. So anyways, he says, my triathlon coach has never used triathlon or trainer road before. Hopefully he's used triathlon before. And I've asked him to select workouts for me, which I do twice a week, and get a longer ride outside on the weekend. He seems to select between VO2 workout like Baird and then a sweet spot workout. And Baird is a VO2 workout like he noted on trainer road. Do you have more guidance for a coach that is new to trainer road on how to best leverage the workouts or plans? He says, of course, he has his own plan for me, but balancing the workouts and everything else. And he said, this may not be a simple solution, but he's targeting a half Ironman race in Asia in April. So this is something that actually, like I've dealt with a lot of coaches on helping them use trainer road, and a ton of coaches use trainer road to manage the training of their athletes. We're going to kind of break it down into four options that you could do mm-hmm. as a coach. And if you're an athlete that is listening to this that has a coach, this can hopefully be helpful for you too. And I think that, yeah, it should actually, I bet it'll bring to light features of Trainer Road that people don't even know about.
Yeah.
So first one, what would it be, Nate?
Option one would be the coach. This is probably the easiest for the coach. They just look through our triathlon plans and mm-hmm. cherry pick the workouts because they're kind of the same energy systems and just say, yep, I'm going to have that one on Sunday, that one on Tuesday, mm-hmm. and then prescribe that to the rider.
Can I take that one step further too?
Sure.
A lot of coaches I know just actually, or some coaches I know, they assign their athletes to just follow our plans. And it kind of gets down to like with a coach, I think that at least for me personally, and I know a lot of athletes are like this, I find the real value of a coach is that like accountability partner, mm-hmm. a counselor, yep. a person to guide me through. And even if perhaps that coach doesn't have experience in the exact race I'm doing, having that outside perspective from an educated person on the matter can be really helpful. So like, I think that that's a true value in a lot of respect of a coach is that accountability partner.
Option two, on our website, we've got great workout filters and you can filter down the workouts and say, I want a sweet spot workout that's about this long. I'm going to order by TSS. Mm-hmm. I can even search for 12 by like 12X and all the 12 minute intervals will come up.
It's pretty sweet.
Inside of that. Yeah. So, and then we have over 1,000 workouts. So that makes it a lot easier to find. Like if the coach says, I want to have my athlete do a 12 minute sweet spot over 2 hours, yeah, they could just do that and then look at the four or five workouts that we have that fit that criteria and assign them.
Yeah. The third option is one where actually the athlete could, let's say that your coach has specific workouts that he wants you to do, and the athlete could then use Workout Creator. We have a Workout Creator and you mm-hmm. can download it. You just go to trainerroad.com/install and you can see it there, or you can look
it's at download.
A download, forgive me. Yeah. And then you can, but you can look online and just click through the links too. But you can recreate that workout that your coach has prescribed for you too.
Yeah, you can either pull one of our existing workouts and just modify it to suit your coach's requirements, or you can just create one from scratch. Yep.
It's fair to say that Chad's quite familiar with the Workout Creator. So.
Quite.
Probably the yep. most in the world.
Spend a lot of day inside that thing.
That's true.
Option four, the coach could create the workout. And then we have a teams function on Trainer Road where you can actually, a coach can create a team, add people to it, and then give private workouts inside of that like shared library mm-hmm. so that when I open Trainer Road, I could go into like, let's say I had a Coach Chad private team, right? Mm-hmm. And no one else could do it. And Chad would invite me to the team. And then I could go into the team section and say, I'm on Coach Chad's team, go in there. And all the workouts are in there.
Yeah.
My sister's doing this. I can tell because their Strava things say like some coaches put, they have the workout name as the date.
Yep.
And it kind of gets around the whole calendar and she's in like a group triathlon class.
Yep.
So they put in the date and it's in there and then everyone opens it up and says, oh, it's the 5th.
That's right.
And they all do the 5th.
And the cool thing is you can actually just in the app, you can just look up the name of that workout, whatever it's supposed to be, if you're part of that team, and it'll show up in your feed. It won't show up in everybody else's. Your coach can just share it with you, so then it shows up in your feed. It's really easy, actually. And some cool things on that too. The coach can then view that athlete's workouts. You can view the athlete's, as a coach, you'd be able to view their notes that they left. You'd be able to see their performance. And you also, there's like a, there's a forums feature within that. So within your team, if you did need a place to facilitate a conversation and keep it isolated from something like email or anything else, you have that too. So the Cliff Bar team, for example, they use the Teams function heavily, and they actually have like, they kind of have challenges like workouts of the week that they have to do. And someone devious creates one, and then they all share their commiseration thereafter.
Yeah.
But it's something that I feel like it's an underutilized feature, and it's something that we want to, you know, it's something that, you know, we would love to build out and make even better, of course, as we always are looking to do. But it's something that's really functional and a lot of coaches already use.
Yep.
So hopefully that helps coaches and athletes with coaches figure out how to use TrainerRoad a little better. Thanks for joining us, everybody. And once again, if you're on the live stream, stay with us and we'll answer some of the questions you've submitted as we've been recording this podcast. But if you're joining us with the podcast, thanks for listening. You can submit those questions at trainerroad.com/podcast, and we'll talk to you all next week.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.